last Friday, we were starting to talk about algorithms and complexity. So that's going to be the topic for this week. So before we start on that, are there questions on,
Well, you remember you talked about the optical cavities and things like that? I have this question. Well, when a photon bounces off a mirror, it should interact with the mirror, right?
Yes.
So how does it happen if the wave function doesn't collapse?
So it depends. Yeah, so, okay, so this is related to the other question about when you shine a laser on an atom, why, and, you know, it absorbs a photon, why doesn't that cause decoherence of the atom? So in the specific case that I was talking about, you're kind of storing zero as the qubit states, or zero for no photons and one for one photon. And it's certainly true that when zero photons bounce off a mirror, the momentum transfer is different than when one photon bounces off a mirror. But again, the mirror is it's a very small mirror, but compared to a single photon, the momentum transfer is very small. So it's basically kind of acting like a classical object. And classical objects, while we like to say that they have a well-defined position, a well-defined momentum, they don't. They're really quantum objects that, in some limit of having lots and lots of particles. And the effect is that the position and the momentum of a classical object actually are not that well-defined. They're kind of distributed over some range. It's just that range is kind of fractionally very narrow compared to the total amount of momentum, say, that such a thing would carry. And so the small momentum change that's imparted by one photon bouncing off a mirror that's so much bigger is enough that you have some Gaussian distribution of momenta, and then it gets shifted just by a little bit. Well, it's almost exactly the same state. So the overlap between those two states is very close to one. And so effectively, you don't get any entanglement with the photon. There's a little bit, but it's negligible. And it's not even a significant source of error in this type of experiment. OK, other questions? OK, so then the last thing I was saying on Friday was that our notion of complexity should, by and large, be independent of machine. And remember, I mentioned the Church-Turing thesis, which says that, in fact, the set of functions that you can decide that are computable is independent of the machine you pick. And that's true even if you go from a classical computer to a quantum computer. But of course, just the question of what functions can be decided, that's not the whole story. We're also interested in which ones can be decided efficiently, like in polynomial time. And so in classical computer science, there's a version of the Church-Turing thesis that codifies the idea that polynomial time is independent of the machine. So that's sometimes called the strong Church-Turing thesis or the modern Church-Turing thesis. So the strong Church-Turing thesis says that let's rephrase that. Here, so it says that the complexity of different functions that you might compute differs by only polynomials between different physically reasonable models of computation. Okay, so so this is the one that says that whether you go, you know, on a Mac or a PC, that they can compute basically the same functions. One might be a little bit faster, a little bit slower, but up to polynomial factors, they're going to be the same. And the strong Church-Turing thesis is kind of the basis of a lot of thinking about complexity theory over the years. And what we'll see this week, well, we can't prove this for reasons that I'll describe in a moment, but what we'll see this week is that quantum computing actually challenges the strong Church-Turing thesis. So it seems that whereas if you go to different classical models of computation, the complexity only changes by polynomial factors, there seem to be some problems where a quantum computer can do exponentially better than a classical computer. Okay? And quantum computers are physically reasonable because they're built upon the real laws of physics, quantum mechanics. And you know, people seem to actually be able to build these things. We haven't built big ones yet, not enough to you know, really conclusively show that we can do this. But you know, there doesn't seem to be any in principle barrier to doing so. So to deal with this from a complexity theoretic framework, we have to define a new complexity class that takes into account what a quantum computer can do. So that complexity class is called BQP. And here the B stands for bounded, meaning bounded probability, which I'll get to in the definition. The Q is clearly for quantum. And the P is for polynomial. So the idea here is this is going to be a quantum version of P. So it's going to be the things that can be done in polynomial time on a quantum computer. So BQP is the set of languages for which there exists a quantum algorithm . So first of all, this quantum algorithm should run in polynomial time. And remember, polynomial time means polynomial in the length of the input. And when x is in the language, this algorithm should accept. But accepting for a quantum algorithm is a probabilistic thing, because quantum measurement is going to involve some randomness. So we don't want to say that it accepts with 100% probability. That's too strict. We just want to say it accepts with some good probability. So one way we can codify that is by saying that the output of the algorithm is yes with probability at least 2/3. And that if x is not in the language, then the algorithm outputs no with probability at least 2/3. And so this is the bounded probability, so that the yes answer is bounded above by at least 2/3, and no answer when the is not in language, when x is not in language, the no answer is also bounded by probability at least 2/3. Now, the important thing about this number here is that it's bigger than a half. Because if we're a half, well, then you could do just that well by guessing, right? So it wouldn't really be doing anything for you. But when it's bigger than a half, so it's, for instance, when it's 2/3, then suppose you say, well, 2/3 isn't good enough. I want 9/10 probability of success. Well, what you could do is you could run this algorithm a bunch of times and take the majority, right? And because each time it's accepting getting the right answer with probably at least 2/3, the majority is more likely to be correct. And if you do this enough, you can make this probability as high as you like. Okay, and in fact, since we're running in polynomial time, you should maybe run it only a polynomial number of times. But when you do that, by doing that, you can make this the overall probability of accepting by taking the majority to be exponentially close to 1. Okay? So does everyone understand that definition? So as I said, we think that there's some problems that quantum computers can solve efficiently, meaning they're in BQP, whereas classical computers cannot solve them in polynomial time. They're not in P. So what that means is that we think the diagram of these complexity classes is, well, there's some problems in P, and then BQP is some bigger set of languages. And the thing is, we can't really prove that. In general, it's very hard to prove separations between complexity classes. Let's think about what it means to say that a problem is not in P. Okay, what does it mean for a problem to be hard? How would one try to show that? Yeah.
Is that that number two-thirds? Does it matter to be two-thirds?
Oh, no. Like I said, basically you can set that to be anything that's greater than a half. Okay. For the reason that I said, that if you set it to be a half plus one out of a million, then by repeating it enough and taking the majority, you can still make it greater than two-thirds or whatever you like. Okay. And there's a difference between those, but if it's some constant greater than a half and you're thinking some other constant greater than a half, you only need to repeat a constant number of times. So that changes the overhead by only a constant factor. So that's still going to be BQP. Okay, good. Any other questions? Okay. So to talk about hardness, let me introduce another complexity class. This is a classical complexity class. And another well-known complexity class is called NP. So the name of this is a bit obscure. It comes from non-deterministic polynomial, but it doesn't actually have anything to do with randomness. It's a different sort of thing called the non-deterministic Turing machine. Anyway, NP is a complexity class. So it's the class of languages and NP, roughly speaking, is the set of problems where it might be hard to find the answer to them, but if somebody gives you the answer, it's easy to check that. So that's the rough definition. And so what is the actual definition? So the actual definition is there exists a verifier function. And the verifier takes two inputs. So one of them is going to be the problem instance, and the other is something called the witness. So first of all, this verifier should run in polynomial time. And you're usually going to restrict to witnesses witnesses which are polynomial in the length of the input. And again, there should be there should be two conditions, one when x is in the language and one when x is not in the language. So whenever x is in the language, then there exists some witness such that this verifier applied to applied to x and the witness for x accepts. And the witness should be, again, polynomial in length. And then there's the condition when x is not in the language. And so when x is not in the language, when x is in the language, you want to be convinced that it is in the language. So the witness and the verifier together tell you this. But that doesn't, you know, convince you unless it's also true that when x is not in the language, that there's no witness that would work. So that's what this says. So for all x not in the language, for all w with polynomial length, then the verifier will reject. Okay? So W. So it's the witness. It's like testifying to the truth of the instance X. Okay? So maybe let's do an example so you can kind of see how this definition works in practice. So let me define the problem KSAT. It's K satisfiability. So KSAT, the input, the instance, is a Boolean formula. So it's, you know, something that takes n variables. And these are Boolean variables, so they can be true or false. And then the rest of the input is going to be m clauses with m to be polynomial in n. And a clause is of the form L I 1 or L I 2 or L I K. So there's K, these L's are called literals, and there's K literals in the clause, and the clause is the or of these things. So first of all, a literal is either a variable or not the log, well, I mean, it's the logical or, but it could be either one of the variables or it could be not of one of the variables. Okay, and then the clause is the or of these things. So for instance, if you had x1 or x2 or x3, that would be a clause that's true if any of x1, x2, and x3 are true. Okay? And it's false if they're all false. Okay? Is that clear? And so then the overall formula, so this definition gives a formula, an overall Boolean formula, which is the AND of these things. Of the clauses, C1 and C2 and CM. And so the question, the KSAT problem, is to say, given a formula, is there a satisfying assignment for this formula? So is there a way we can assign true and false to the variables xi such that every clause in this formula is true? Okay, so we say that the formula is in ksat, meaning it's a yes instance. So in that case, there exists some assignment of xi's such that this formula evaluates to true. Okay?
So what was the question?
Sorry, so this is a language that I'm defining. And the language, so the way the language works, remember, represents a decision problem. And so the decision problem is, I give you a Boolean formula like this, and the question is, does there exist a satisfying assignment? So does there exist a set of xi's, assignment to the xi's, true and false, each variable, such that the formula is true? Okay? And so you can immediately see, I hope, that ksat is in NP. Why? Well, what is the witness and what is the verifier? The witness is just the satisfying assignment. Okay. So if you're given a formula that's in ksat, then there is a satisfying assignment. So I just give it to you. And then the verifier is just to evaluate f. Okay? So this, you can see that that verifier runs easily in polynomial time, because you just have to, I mean, it's just linear in the number of clauses to do this. Because k, I should say, is a constant. So for instance, you can set it equal to 3, for example. It's a good number. So we have verifier, it runs in polynomial time. If x is in the language, then there is a witness that satisfies it, because the satisfying assignment will evaluate to true. That's what we want. And if x is not in the language, well, then that means there is no satisfying assignment. So that whatever, you know, if somebody lies to you and says, oh, here, I think it's a true instance, they give you a witness, something that they claim is a witness. But then you can easily check it, and you'll see that it doesn't work, right? So that's straightforward. Just direct application of the definition, you see that this problem is in NP. OK? So let's see. One thing to point out, a bunch of things to point out. So one thing is that there's this asymmetry between the yes instances and the no instances. That the yes instances, there exists a witness, so we can check that very easily. In the no instances, well, there's not necessarily any way to prove that very easily. Right? If somebody gives you a Boolean formula and says this is not in ksat, you might ask them to prove it, but they don't have a convenient way to do that. They can say, well, I checked everything and it doesn't work. But whereas verifying that a particular witness does work, that takes only polynomial time. Checking all the witnesses to see that none of them work, that's going to take exponential time, right? Because if there's n variables, there's 2 to the n possible truth assignments that you have to check. Okay, and the upshot is that this is one of these cases where so NP is kind of this class where it might be easy to check the answer when it's given to you. But this gives you a sense of why it might be hard to find that answer. Because you might have to run through all of these different truth assignments to find the one truth assignment that works. Of course, there might be more than one. There might be many of them. And there are certainly some satisfiability formulas that are very easy. Because you can look at them and say, well, this one says that x1 has to be true. And this clause says that x1 has to be false. So clearly, that doesn't have an answer. But you can also have much more subtle contradictions that you have to look at the whole thing, and it's very difficult to see how to see that it doesn't work. Ksat is a good example of a problem in NP, and we're pretty sure that it's not in P. So why do we think that? Well, in general, this class NP seems to be bigger than P. There's lots that can and has been said about that. I won't have time to get into most of that. But in particular, we know that KSAT, and in particular 3SAT, is one of the hardest problems. In NP. And we think that NP contains some problems that are not in P. Actually, we think that NP contains some problems that are not in BQP either. But conversely, we think there's some BQP problems that are not in NP. And so KSAT is probably out here somewhere, even 3SAT. So, so before I go to the next topic, are there questions on definition of NP, definition of satisfiability, things like that? Yeah.
Don't we have anything like if we can solve one NP problem in time P, then we can solve all other things?
Not exactly, but that's actually the next topic. So that's what I was going to do. But I want to make sure what people got these definitions down. Before I get into that. Okay, so what does it mean to say that KSAT is one of the hardest problems in NP? Well, specifically what it means is that not if you can solve an arbitrary NP problem, but if you can solve KSAT, then you can solve arbitrarily problems in NP. And so that's something that you can actually talk about rigorously. The way we do that is through the following definition of a reduction. So we say that a language L reduces to a language M if there exists some polynomial time function mapping bit strings to bit strings that maps L into M, basically, such that X is an L if and only if F of X is an M. Okay. So this is actually a case where I do have a joke that's relevant to the material. So this joke is about, well, the way I heard it was about an engineer, a physicist, and a mathematician. But in this case, I'm going to change mathematician to computer scientist because that's what makes it most relevant. So anyway, so the engineer, the physicist, and the computer scientist, they all go to the same conference. And they're staying in the same hotel. And so one night at this conference, they're having drinks after dinner. And the engineer says, I had a terrible experience last night. There was a fire in the trash can in my hotel room. And so they say, wow, what happened? And the engineer says, well, you know, I was frightened for a moment, but then I pulled it together, and I filled the ice bucket with water, and I dumped it on the fire, and it put it out. OK, so it wasn't that big a deal, but you know, it gave me a moment of worry. So OK, so then they all go to bed. And in the middle of the night, the physicist wakes up. And he finds that his wastebasket is also on fire. So what he says is, well, OK, I can do better than the engineer. I'll write down, he sits down, writes down a quick calculation, figures out the exact amount of water he needs to put out this fire, fills up the ice bucket with that much water, puts out the fire, and then he can go back to sleep. OK, great. And he mentions this to the computer scientist and the engineer at dinner the next day. And so then third night, the computer scientist is the one that wakes up in the middle of the night, and there's a fire in his wastebasket. And so he says, OK, I know what to do. He goes to the ice bucket, and it's already full of water. And he panicked because this is a different situation. He doesn't know what to do. But then he thinks, and he realizes, oh, I can just dump out the water. And then I can fill up the ice bucket and put out the fire. So thus reducing it to a problem previously solved. Okay, so that's what this notion of reduction does. It takes you from the easier problem to the harder problem. So the point is that of this definition is that if you can solve M, you can solve L. Because L is easier than M. Okay? Because you can turn L into an example of M by putting it into this function. So that's what the computer scientist does here. He solves the ice bucket already full problem by turning it into an example of ice bucket empty. Okay? And so that's what this function in this case does, is it maps the full ice bucket to the empty ice bucket. And so this works for you know, more general computational problems. And so in particular, if you take any problem in NP, it turns out you can reduce it to an example of k-satisfiability. And so that means that k-satisfiability is something called that NP-complete. So we say a language is NP-complete if any languages, any language in NP, will reduce to M. Okay, and so what we can do is we can say, well, suppose you're given. So this is where the argument that comes from, that it's unlikely that KSAT has a polynomial time algorithm, right? Because if, well, okay. So let me just complete this by writing up the relevant theorem. So Cook-Levin theorem says that a 3-sat is NP complete. And so what this means is that if there were a polynomial time algorithm to solve 3-satisfiability, then you could solve all problems in NP in polynomial time. And P would actually be equal to NP. This is a famous open problem. We don't know actually how to prove that they're different. But most people believe that they are. So why does this mean that there's no polynomial time algorithm for 3-sat? Well, suppose you had a polynomial time algorithm for 3-sat. And you're given some other language in NP. Well, what you can do is you can use the reduction. You know, that language will reduce to 3-sat. And so what you can do is you can reduce it to 3-sat, and then use your polynomial time algorithm to solve the instance of 3-sat that you get. And that instance is in 3-sat if and only if the original instance that you started with is in the language that you started with. Okay. So a polynomial time algorithm to decide 3-sat would give you a polynomial time algorithm to solve to decide any language in NP. Okay? And so therefore, if 3-sat has a polynomial time algorithm, then P equals NP. And actually, the nice thing about this reduction is it doesn't really depend on thinking about P or NP. I mean, it depends. The statement is that it's NP complete. So it does depend on NP. But it doesn't depend on P. So if you were to come up with a polynomial time quantum algorithm to solve 3-sat, that would also give you a polynomial time quantum algorithm to solve any language in NP. OK. But this big open problem, whether P equals NP, there just don't exist classical techniques or quantum techniques to prove that these things are not equal. So the best we can do in general to say that a problem is hard is to say something like, well, we can do maybe a little bit more than this, but we can say things like, this problem is NP complete, and we don't think that P is equal to NP, so therefore this problem should be hard. Okay? So basically all the complexity theoretic proofs, with very few exceptions, that things are hard are really just statements that, well, if this were true, then something else bad would happen. Something that we think is not true. So you have a whole bunch of results that say that certain problems are NP-complete, and that means that we think that they're hard. Okay, so but we still, you know, want some evidence that we can look at to say that problems are hard. So one approach people tried originally to prove that P is not equal to NP, but it's still a kind of a useful technique for studying problems, is to study the Oracle model. Okay, so what are oracles? So an oracle is kind of a black box. It's a black box. We don't know what's going on inside, but we can ask it questions and we can get answers. So in particular, we think of the oracle as a function mapping, say, n-bit strings to bits. And so we give it some input x, we get the output o of x, and we have no idea how this oracle is computing O of X. Okay? And the advantage of this model is that it's actually much easier to prove things in. Because we define a notion of complexity that's related to our lack of knowledge here. So what we're going to do is, so we can make queries to the Oracle by giving it inputs. And seeing what the outputs are. So we define a notion of complexity, the query complexity, by counting queries. So suppose we're given some oracle, and we're allowed to make queries to this oracle. We want to compute some function of this oracle. We want to learn something about it. I'll give you an example in a minute. So so the query complexity of computing this function is the minimum number of queries you have to make calculate F. And so in the classical context, you're probably going to talk about the deterministic query complexity. But it also makes sense to talk about the randomized query complexity, which can be less. So when you're making kind of random, where you can make random choices. So for instance, you can generate randomly X's. And then, of course, we're also going to talk about the quantum query complexity. So I'll have to define what it means to have a quantum oracle. So what's an example of this? So an example I'll be talking about today is we're given, so this is a promise problem, this particular question. So this promise problem, you're given an oracle. And you're told something about the oracle. So this oracle is has one of two properties. It's either constant, meaning that no matter what input you give it, it gives you the same output. or it's balanced, which means that the number of inputs that give the output 0 is the same as the number of inputs that give the output 1. Okay? And the function that you want to compute of the oracle is just, is it constant or is it balanced? So the reason this is a promise problem is because there's a promise on the oracle. It doesn't, this function, f of o, doesn't work for all possible oracles. But for oracles in this class, it's well defined. So another, so let me define very quickly another oracle problem to give you an idea of the type of thing you can do that we'll be talking about later in the week, which you can think of as a search problem. So given oracle O, then you want to know is O of X equal to 0 for all X? Actually, a better one is the inverse problem. So does there exist an X 0, say, such that O of x0 is equal to 1. Okay. So of course, if the answer to this is yes, then the answer to the other question was no. So this problem is kind of a search problem, because basically the oracle, you can think of the oracle as a long, long list. We don't know how it's computed. So one example people like to give is a phone book. And you have a certain number, phone number, and you want to know if that number is in the phone book. Okay? And so you might have to look through the whole phone book to find this phone number. So this search problem is kind of a model also for NP problems, right? Because the witness is this x0, and you might have to search through all possible witnesses to find the one that works. Okay, so there are questions on this oracle model. Definition.
What sort of mathematical object is the function f?
So f. So okay. So you can think of O as a very long bit string. Okay. Because what you can do is you can think of, well, the on the input all zeros, it outputs bit O sub zero. And on the input 00001, it outputs O of 1, and so on. So on all possible 2 to the n possible inputs, it outputs a bit. And so you can think of O as a bit string of length 2 to the n that lists all of these answers in order. Okay, given that bit string, you could just look in the right place and find what O of a particular value is. And so then f is just some function on bit string of length 2 to the n. And I guess we're mostly interested in decision problems again, so we'll say it maps them to bit strings. So, sorry, to bits. Okay? Other questions? Okay. So it turns out that this first problem, the constant balanced oracle problem, if you want to deterministically solve it in the classical case, it's going to take it's going to take exponentially many queries. In particular, because you want to do it with 100% probability, if we're doing it deterministically, well, if you only try 2 to the n minus 1 possible inputs, it's possible you got unlucky, and you find that they're all the same, possibly just got unlucky, and that those were the ones that were all the same, and that the next one you try might be different, right? Because there's two to the number of zeros in the constant case, the number of zeros is the same as the number of ones. So there's two to the n minus one zeros and two to the n minus one ones. So you might have to take two to the n minus one plus one queries. And so that's the best possible, it requires a little bit more proof, but that's the best possible classical algorithm to compute the query complexity. And so the interesting thing about this Oracle model is you can actually prove things like this because we don't know anything else about the black box. So let me just leave it at that for the moment. But in the quantum case, we can do better. So first, I should define what I mean by a quantum query. So quantum query, basically, what happens is you have to make this oracle reversible and then think of it as a quantum state. So what we're going to do is we have the black box that computes O. But instead of just having one input x, which is now going to be a ket because it's quantum, we're going to give it two inputs, some ancilla. And the output will keep the input x around in order to make it reversible. And so one output is x, and one output is going to be x plus the oracle, sorry, a plus the oracle applied to x. Binary addition. OK? So this is just what we talked about last Monday for making a general classical function reversible. So we're just doing that. And then we're making it quantum by putting kets around it. So of course, that means you can also query when these inputs are in superpositions. And then what you'll get is the same superposition of the outputs. OK? Questions on the quantum oracle? OK, and so then we have a quantum algorithm that can decide this constant balanced problem in just, as it happens, a constant number of queries. So the one I'm going to show you uses two queries, and that can actually be improved to one. So the Deutsch-Jose algorithm is a quantum algorithm for this problem. And it uses two queries, and it looks like this. So we're going to take two sets of qubits, but they both start in state 0. And then this first set, we're going to do the Hadamard to each of them. Second one stays 0. And then we apply the oracle. So this thing, this register here, is our x register. And this register here is the ancilla A register, OK, on the oracle. So then we have the outputs. Then what we're going to do is we're going to apply the sigma z to the A register, and then apply the oracle again. And then we don't really need the ancilla anymore, actually. So then we're going to do the Hadamard again to the X register, and then measure these bits. And then looking at this output, so we get two possibilities. One case, if the output is all zeros, then we conclude that the function is constant. And otherwise, we decide the function, the oracle is balanced. Okay. Yeah.
So how is the balanced version of this quantum query?
What do you mean? So this quantum query that I've drawn up here, that works for any oracle, any classical oracle. You can turn it into a reversible thing here. So that's just what I'm doing here.
Right. But I'm thinking about if you give it a superposition, then what did you do?
Ah, okay. Well, we'll see an example as we work through this particular case. So I want to show you why this works. I'm not just going to write up this thing and say go away. Okay. So why does this work? So we'll call this initial state 0, and this time step will be 1, this time step will be 2, this time step is 3, this will be time step 4, and then here at the end we'll have time step 5. Okay, so let's see. So first I want to observe that so for the z, I don't remember if I wrote this down before, sigma z, so it looks like this. And Hadamard, you remember, looked like this. And so Hadamard, it's convenient to write it in a slightly different way. So its effect on Ketz, if you put it on a single bit like this, then it takes you to the sum over y minus 1 to the x dot y, ignoring normalization, y. Okay. And of course, y is just a bit. So here we're summing over 0 and 1. And so x dot y is going to be just the product. So it's we get a minus 1 if and only if x and y are 1. So that's this minus 1 down here. Okay. And the reason I want to write it this way is that if you apply Hadamard to many bits at once, well, you can think of a string of many bits as a vector in a binary vector space. And the output will again be the same number of bits. So again, it's going to be a vector in the same dimensional vector space, binary vector space. And the formula looks the same, applying Hadamard to all n bits at the same time. So instead of taking x times y, we take x dot y as vectors, right? Because that's the sum of the product x and y on each of the bits. And that's what we're doing. We're multiplying together minus 1 if each particular bit is both x and y is 1. OK? So let's go through. Maybe I should go back over. Okay, let's go through and see what happens in the cases where the oracle is constant or balanced. Okay, well, okay, I'll start to write here and then hopefully that will dry and I can use some of that. So, so if it's constant, well, so it's step 0. That's easy. We just have all zeros for the first register and 0 for the ancilla. And then at step 1, well, now we've applied the Hadamard to the first register, to all bits of the first register. So what does this Hadamard formula tell us? Well, we started with all zeros, so x dot y is always going to be 0 for any y. So that means that this is all pluses here. And so we just have a sum over all possible values of y. So we have, except I'm going to call it x now, to be consistent with the oracle notation there. and the ancilla bit is still 0. Okay? And then step 2, so this is where the superposition into the oracle happens. So step 2, the oracle computes O of x in the second ancilla, in the ancilla bit. And because we have superposition, the output is going to be a superposition over all of these possible answers. So what we get is we get a sum over x of x, O of x. So in general, for an arbitrary oracle, this could be an entangled state. Okay, but of course, for the specific case of a constant function, O of x is always the same, so it's not actually entangled. But we don't know that yet. Let's see. Okay. So then at step 3, we've applied a phase shift that depends on O of x. So we have now sum over x minus 1 to the O of x. That's what z does. And then x of x. And then the second query to the oracle, well, it undoes this calculation. Because the output, you see, could be of the second bit could be a plus O of x. O of x is the same, so we get O of x plus O of x. Binary arithmetic, that's 0. So here we have sum over x minus 1 to the O of x, 0. And of course, since the function is constant, this O of x is always the same. So this phase is always the same for all possible values of x. And so we can just take it out front. So this is going to be plus or minus sum over x, 0. Okay, and then at step 5, we apply the Hadamard to these bits, and we get back all zeros. Plus or minus 0, 0. Why do we get back all zeros? Well, so in this case, x is varying, but it's a little more complicated calculation. It's maybe easiest to think about this bit by bit. If you just calculate on a single bit, if you apply 0 plus 1, you do Hadamard to that, well, the 1s cancel out because you have a 1 and a minus 1. And then you just get a 0. You can do that calculation. That's not hard. Sorry, okay, I thought you were going to ask a question. Are there questions?
Isn't it possible just to say that the Hadamard square is identical?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's enough to prove it. So anyway, so the upshot here is that when the function is constant, we do, in fact, get the all zeros output, which is what this thing says that we should be getting. So then we have to see in the balance case that we're not getting all zeros. So this part works. OK, so what about the balance case? Well, the balance case, I mean, I didn't really use that it was constant until step 4 here. So let's start from there. So at step 4, we still have this sum over x minus 1 to the O of x, and then 0 on the ancilla. But now we can't take this minus 1 to the O of x out front, because sometimes it's plus 1 and sometimes it's minus 1. Half the time, exactly. So to see what happens, let phi be this state, the one that we actually have. And we'll let psi be the thing without any signs. So this is the state that we have up to a possible minus sign in the constant case. Okay, and the thing to observe is that because the function is balanced, psi and phi are orthogonal. right? Because what is this? This is equal to the sum of, well, we're definitely going to get 0 unless we have the same thing on the left and the right. But it, maybe I should write it out anyway. X, y. So we have sum over x for psi. And then we have minus 1 to the O of y, y. Okay. And this thing here, well, this is sum x and y minus 1 to the O of y, x, y, which is, well, this is delta x, y. So this is just sum over x minus 1 to the O of x. And O of x is 0 half the time and 1 half the time. So we get an equal number of plus 1s and minus 1s here. And so that's why this is equal to 0. Okay? And so the thing is that the go between step 4 and step 5, we apply the Hadamard. The Hadamard is unitary. So what that means is that that Hadamard applied to phi is still going to be orthogonal to Hadamard applied to psi. And Hadamard applied to psi is all zeros. Hadamard applied to phi is the output of the algorithm in step 5 when we have balanced. Okay? So what that means is that when we measure this state, the overlap on 0 is 0. So we can never get the output all zeros. Okay? Almost done. And so that's what we needed here. Because if we get the output all zeros, we had to conclude it was constant. And if we get any other output, it's balanced. Now, balance can give you any other output. But that's OK. So there's just lots of things that we lump into to that one answer of balance. OK? So that's the Deutsch-Jost algorithm. And you see that whereas in the classical case it took exponentially many queries, here we only need 2 queries to solve it with 100% probability. So are there questions on this?
Well, I'm not sure if the classical case is exponential. I mean, shouldn't we consider log of n instead of n?
No. So again, I understand where you're coming from here. So in some sense, the input is the oracle. But normally when we consider query complexity, we do it as a function of the size of the input to the oracle. I mean, that's just a question. In any case, it's still an improvement, right? Because whatever it is, it's much better in the classical case, in the quantum case. Whether you call the original thing exponential or polynomial is kind of up to you. The main point is that the quantum advantage is exponential. Yeah?
Why is it 2 queries in the quantum case?
I've used 2 queries. One to compute, one to uncompute. So why do I need to uncompute? Actually, that's a very important point. This is not a good example. But we're in order to get the all zeros thing here, we need this superposition to be not an entangled state within syllable, but in a tensor product. And in particular, if in the balance case, at step 3, I didn't write it, but at step 3, if we didn't uncompute the oracle, we'd have that n-syllabit lying around that would remember which kind of oracle it was, which output it was. And then we would have an entangled state. And then when we did the Hadamard, well, this argument wouldn't hold true. It wouldn't be orthogonal anymore. It would just be either superposition over the plus states or superposition over the minus states. And we would have some probability of getting the all zeros output. And so it wouldn't work. This is what I meant when I said it's really important in the quantum case to uncompute things. Okay. So it turns out you can actually use just one Oracle query, and I guess that's one of the tutorial problems for today. So you'll have a chance to think about that. Okay? Okay. So yeah, tutorial today, and tomorrow we'll start to talk about some more interesting problems other than this artificial one.